Right, good evening. Can I welcome you this evening to Ed Soldier's lecture? My name is Ricky Burdett. I'm director of the Cities Program here at the LSE, and it's a great honor, great pleasure to welcome Ed, who's been a visiting professor in our program here at the school now for 3 years, coming a term at the time from California. It's a great pleasure to have him talk tonight, but also it's the culmination in a way of three intense sessions, over three years, where he's worked with us in the design studio, trying to bring together and forge this new knowledge base, which the Cities Program is involved in, of linking urban social science and urban design. Ed obviously is extraordinarily well placed to help us do this. Maybe he's overpoweringly well placed to do it sometimes when we, as other staff and students, are exposed to his extraordinary knowledge and insights. But it's fantastic to have him here, and it's also fantastic that the school will be inviting him back to continue his presence at the LSE over the next years. In this group at the school, in this audience, I think Ed really does need little introduction as one of the major urban theorists in the world, who really has done groundbreaking work on the city, particularly the American city, but most recently and most interestingly to all of us who follow his work, on what he calls the restructured megacities. In fact, there are a few words that he has invented which are now part of common parlance. And some of these words are the titles of his books, well known to us, the trilogy in particular books, which is now being completed, starting with Postmodern Geographies, again, a word which is part of the discourse. Third Space, a concept of actually looking at physical space and its role in the understanding of city form and city mechanisms, was the second of the publications. And the third, which you know and I'm plugging on your behalf, right, in case you haven't bought it, you have to go tomorrow morning, is Post-Metropolis, a critical studies of cities and regions. What is, I think, interesting to me as an architect and the engagement we've had with Ed in the studio, and what the nature of the engagement is that it transcends the classic lecture and seminar and involves Ed, together with other colleagues here, in talking to students who are designing bits of cities. What it involves is having Ed sit down and look at drawings and comment and react. And what you have is this extraordinary sense of a visceral feel that Ed has for the city and how it works. Whether it's Chatanghuyuk, which you may or may not be talking about tonight, whether it's the politics or the corruption in Orange County, or whether it's the effect of globalization on the streets of Aldgate, which is a project we've been looking at over the last few months, in fact, also last year, Ed is just able to tell you about it and reveal things which we've been staring at for years and just haven't noticed. And I think in that sense, it is an extraordinary insight and refreshing creativity that he has as an urban theorist, which is deeply relevant to all the professions represented at the school and the urban design professions and the politicians. Tonight he's talking, as you know from the poster, on a subject which is entitled Putting Cities First. And characteristically for him, he's challenging conventional wisdom in social science and challenging conventional wisdom in design. He's exploring in this lecture what he calls really the essence of cities. Are they the background for human life, as is conventionally seen, or actually can the city itself, its shape, its form, even its buildings, may one say, actually shape social life itself? So it's with great pleasure that I welcome, and I would like you to welcome Ed to give this talk, Putting Cities First. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Is this on, by the way?
Can you hear? Is the microphone on?
I can speak loudly, but
it should be on.
If there is a microphone. Is the microphone working?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yes. I want to first thank Ricky Burdett for not only a wonderful introduction, but for his participation with others like Richard Sennett and many others, for creating an extraordinarily exciting island in the Cities program. Each year, I discover more and more exciting things have happened in the interim between my last visit and my present visit. And I'm hoping that this developing and rolling excitement will continue into the future. Today I'm going to sort of, although it's the last of what appears to be a series of lectures focusing upon architects and design, I'm going to take a significant jump up in scale and probably also in levels of abstraction in discussing some of these arguments under the title of Putting Cities First. I want to start with elaborating a bit on a nice old Greek word. The word is synikismos, S-Y-N-O-I-K-O-S-M-O-S. Let me start by sort of taking it apart, parsing it a bit. The core of the word is oikos, very familiar, ekos, I should say. I've been corrected by my Greek students and others. The core is this notion of ekos, which is, of course, the stem, the root of the term economics. Ekos basically means home, and those of you in economics realize that your field is field was born as home economics. Economics is one of the roots. Ecology is another root. Ecumene is another term derived from that same root, as is a more recent term, ecistics, the study of human settlements, which indeed is something that will be reconnected back into that word as I discuss it further. The ending MOS means basically the conditions arising from the home, the ecos, and the SYN indicates some kind of coming together. So in its simplest form, synikismos, or as I will translate it, synikism, refers to the kind of interdependent unity that derives from dwelling together in some home place or home space. The various conditions that are associated with living together in space, in place. I hear that the term is sometimes used in Greek to refer to wedlock. Again, another kind of interdependent unity, coming together to dwell interdependently in one place. I will add several layers to this notion of synikism, because it is a very wonderfully flexible word that has been connected into a number of interesting arenas and debates. And I will be using it today as the kind of frontispiece or window, if you will, to try to understand the arguments I'm going to make about this concept of or notion of putting cities first. Spelled O-E-C with an O-E-C-I-S-M rather than my E-K, cynicism, which has obviously some problems in using that pronunciation. Cynicism is a word that one can find distributed fairly heavily in the archaeological literature to refer to the process whereby city-states were formed. Indeed, the processes by which cities were first formed, as a kind of coming together to dwell interdependently in some concentrated settlement, a home space, a home place. Aristotle used the term in part directly to refer to this process of city formation or city-state formation, but added several new layers to it, a kind of notion of territorial confederation, a kind of creation of some kind of political and cultural unity in this process of forming the city and the city-state. He spoke about synikismos as the origin of politics in that root word, the polis, the word that gives the meaning to the word police and policy as well as politics. So we have a whole series of layers that are related to a whole set of other concepts and words spinning off from that root term. As I've mentioned a few, others, of course, we relate to the city and civilization and city-based civilization, and also these this other part of city words. A lot of words in Latin and Greek, like polis and civitas, referred directly to the urban, but also refer to a form of civilized behavior, civility, urbanity, politeness. All of these are packaged as the kind of double of the concept of the city. We know relatively little about this notion of synikismos or synikism because it hasn't traveled very well. That is, one can search the literature in the social sciences, and even in specialized urban studies, and find almost no mention of this notion of synikism after the period of the Greek city-state, where you see the word being used very frequently to refer to all kinds of territorial confederations, not just for Athens. The closest we have today to something that attempts to study what I call synikismos and define now in a broad way as the stimulus of urban agglomeration, the kind of creative and often innovative, but sometimes negative, stimulus that derives from this process of people moving together to settle in dense, usually heterogeneous settlements. Right? The stimulus of urban agglomeration has been studied, as I say, rarely, but one exception, I think, is an interesting literature that flourishes in part here at LSE on agglomeration economies. Agglomeration economies, those of you who know about the history of that term and that concept, know that they are sometimes called external economies, sometimes called locational economies, but significantly, even in that literature, they are also called urbanization economies. That is, the economies, the efficiencies, and the associated kinds of advantages, competitive, locational, economic, as well as other kinds of advantages, that derive from the nature of cityness. So what we're talking about in this notion of synikism is something that is right at the heart of what cities are. Now, what I want to do today is to take this notion of synikism and use it to illustrate an argument about the power, the explanatory, the kind of causal is rather strong, but I'm suggesting causal or explanatory power that is embedded in the very nature of cities, in what I will call urban spatiality. Right? Rather than using urban space, I use the word spatiality, even with its clumsiness, in part to indicate that I'm speaking about socially constructed, socially made space, rather than space in the pure abstract. This is socially worked space that I mean when I use the term spatiality. The city as a spatially worked space, place. And what I'm arguing today is that this urban spatiality can be seen as a powerful explanatory factor for major events in the historical development of human societies, as well as everyday behavior and everyday life. But the second point I'm going to make and try to elaborate a little bit further on is that we've not dealt with this kind of this mode of explanation in the social sciences, and even in urban studies for most of the past 200 years. And so it is through this notion of putting cities first that I'm going to elaborate about the need to begin to explore anew this explanatory power embedded in the very nature of cityness that is characterized by the innovative stimulus that arises from urban agglomeration. Now, again, as a caution, I'm not trying to say that urban spatiality can be used to explain everything, although I may sound as if I'm going to be making that argument, but I really am not. What I'm trying to say is that we've neglected to consider urban spatiality as a significant part of the way in which we explain the most important phenomena in human life and human society. That we need to restore this emphasis through exploring for a moment, for tonight at least, what might happen if we put this form of understanding and explanation first, rather than as a secondary or third or even neglected factor, and look at some key issues, key problems, to try to see what it can help us, how it can help us in understanding these in other ways, in new ways. I also, I'm going to imply that this neglect has created a very interesting situation in that we've only begun to restore this explanatory power. And one might guess, however, that there might be some extraordinary potential in opening up radically different ways of explaining things than have been already established in the existing literatures. But first, let me try to contextualize this task of putting cities first and trying to understand the explanatory power of urban spatiality. Because part of the argument, or most of the argument I'm making tonight, would have been almost incomprehensible 10 years ago. I don't think I could have given this lecture 10 years ago with any expectation that even a small fraction of the audience would understand what I'm saying and why I'm saying it. What this means is that I think something very significant has happened in the 1990s to create a much larger and much more receptive audience to arguments of this kind. What has happened is something that a few people have begun to call a spatial turn. And it's something that has had an extraordinarily wide effect throughout virtually all disciplines. It's been not just a spatial turn in the social sciences, or in any other particular discipline, but it's been a turn, a kind of resurgence of interest and understanding of the power of spatial thinking occurring across the board, in a sense, in a kind of transdisciplinary change. This is a major event. This is a kind of turnaround from 150 years in which spatial thinking has been relatively peripheral to the most powerful forces of the social sciences, of scientific socialism, of socialist theory, of the humanities, of other disciplines, of political, cultural, and social theory, most of which have been dominated by a kind of combination of social and historical explanations, explanations drawing upon the powerful historicality of human life and the powerful sociality of human life. And as I've been arguing for many years, this kind of an exaggerated emphasis on the social and the historical has created a kind of blinkering, a blunting of the importance of spatial thinking over the past 150 years, at least. What has been happening in the 90s is a kind of breaking down of that domination of what I've called social historicism, and the emergence of a kind of greater sensitivity to the equal importance of the spatial to the social and the historical. A kind of rebalancing beginning to take place. It's far from having taken place. We are still in a kind of condition when social historicism tends to dominate our thinking about the history of human society and of contemporary life. But we're beginning, as I say, since the mid-1990s, to appreciate the growing importance of spatial kinds of thinking, spatial kinds of explanation. As I said, this is a bit of a recovery because maybe more than 150 years ago there was a much greater balance between the three. But over these 150 years, there has been a very significant process of peripheralizing the importance of spatial thinking and of, if you want, geographical thinking with regard to historical and sociological thought. This transdisciplinary change, as I said, is rather unusual then. Spatial thinking is no longer as confined as it once was to the so-called spatial disciplines, geography, architecture, urban and regional studies, these traditional places where space plays a vital, central role. These were the ones that sort of kept spatial thinking alive, these disciplines, over these past 150 years. But now, the same kind of spatial thinking that characterized these disciplines, sometimes even more innovative spatial thinking, has begun to spread to many other disciplines which, for the past century and a half, have never been so powerfully and centrally spatial. First, in the social sciences, with the possible exception of American sociology and maybe a couple of corners of British sociology, there's been a kind of mini-spatial turn in virtually every social science. The most interesting for me has been what has been happening in anthropology, in terms of not just urban anthropology and the kind of other developments in sort of post-colonial studies and other studies, but again, a kind of significant shift of attention to important spatial issues in anthropology being achieved with great deals of insight and care. But also, of course, in economics. Most surprisingly, perhaps, there's been a significant spatial turn in economics. There were some blunted mini turns in the past, but this one seems much more serious than any of these other earlier ventures of economics into the world that exists off the space, the head of a pin, to quote a famous argument some years ago about the nature of neoclassical economics. This turn is symbolized perhaps to me by a very interesting development. The Harvard Business School, for the first time, now has a almost required course in economic geography. By the way, I think the only geography course taught at Harvard is an economic geography course taught in the business school, indicative of the beginnings of a significant attachment within economics and a significant understanding of the spatial dimension of economics. This extension in economics is perhaps most amazing to me in such subfields as accounting. There's been the beginnings of a kind of spatial rethinking of accounting taking place, and I gather the accounting department at LSE has been one of the participants in this development. So, as I said, there is this significant spread within the social sciences, but even more so in the humanities, in comparative literature and literary criticism, in art history and art criticism very heavily, in film studies, in communication studies, in poetry, in novel writing. There has been, brewing a little earlier, but significantly taking off in the 1990s, this resurgence of attention and importance given to the notion of the spatiality of human life and its power to shape our behavior, our thoughts, our activities. What I'm going to do tonight is not continue to make this argument about space more generally, but to argue that now piggybacking, so to speak, on the spatial turn, has been the beginnings of a distinctive urban turn in that sense. That is a kind of similar diffusion of awareness of the importance of the urban and of, in particular, urban spatiality as a powerful factor in our lives. This is also the attention being given to the urban as a causal or explanatory factor is very much like the attention given to space more generally. That is, it has tended over the past 150 years to be relatively peripheral, relatively minor, de-emphasized in the development of social theory and social science, and even, as I say, in a field that we call urban studies. Two periods can be identified in these 150 years that have been particularly powerful in peripheralizing the urban as an explanatory factor. The first very powerful part of what was happening in the late 19th century with the formation of the social sciences was led by the three continuing great figures of Western social thought, Marx, Weber, and Durkheim, the great trilogy, the three wise men that continue to be referred to as the most powerful influences on Western social thought even today. Each one of these three paid significant attention to cities. They wrote about cities, for the most, especially Marx and Weber, but sidetracked any attempt to give any explanatory power to cities. Cities were pushed into a kind of background as a stage or a container for life, rather than as anything that is actually shaping social relations, shaping society. This is the traditional way in which urban space, urban spatiality, has been considered. This, again, deadens any kind of explanatory power. Michel Foucault was perhaps one of the first to identify and notice this peculiar process, not just with respect to the urban, but particularly more broadly with respect to spatiality in general. And in a kind of a quotation that I've used so many times and many others have repeated over and over again because of its brilliant insight, he said something happened in the 19th century. He asked, you know, did it start with Bergson? It doesn't matter. But he says something happened to make space be considered as fixed, dead, background, environment, non-problematic, a kind of mere stage for human life where interesting things happen in but do not derive from. Right? Whereas time was in many ways the opposite. Time was dynamic, developmental, it was process, it was generative, it was dialectical, it was filled with life, élan, in stark contrast to the way space was conceived. Space was sort of background, environment, container, stage for human life, for human action. History, the social making of history, that was where the action was. And especially so for Marx and Weber, and I think also an argument can be made for Durkheim. This was the first major period, and in many ways it's quite amazing that a powerful spatial interpretive school would develop out of this crushing kind of way of looking at time and space, but it did in the interwar years. The most significant school to use some form of spatial explanation, urban spatial explanation, develops in the interwar years at the University of Chicago. Develops as the Chicago School of Urban Ecology, has a major influence on the social sciences and the development of the social sciences in America in the 20s and the 30s, and presents one of the most systematic theorizations in all of the social sciences in which some form of urban causality is absolutely central. much of what is studied by the Chicago School and by all of urban sociology in the 20s and 30s was something that derived from the very nature of the city as a kind of ecological crucible, it called it. It was a place that made things occur and association with its particular spatial organization, or in their words, particular ecology. But ever since the late 1930s, when the Chicago School peaked, much of sociology and the social sciences has been draining away that explanatory power from the so-called ecologism of the Chicago School. So much so that today, much of American, as I said before, sociology, and parts of British sociology in particular, no longer give any major attention to that urban qualifier. Sociology was born as urban sociology, and it's always been urban sociology. But today, most sociologists, again, as I say, especially so in the United States, study social phenomena, stratification, class, ethnicity, crime, delinquency, family, etc., as things that occur in cities. They just happen to occur in cities, but never as things that are of cities, that are shaped significantly by the fact that they are occurring in cities. So this kind of thing has drained. Geography and economics have been the only places where they sort of kept alive some of the primitive notions of the Chicago School and its form of spatial explanation. The field of geography often keeps its spatial explanations private because most of the people outside won't accept any kind of environmental causality. But inside, geographers know that there's a degree to which, and so do architects in terms of design and the impact of design. Inside the spatial disciplines, there is a kind of sharing of this knowledge that there is some degree of causality coming from the very nature of urbanism and the urban built environment and urban geographies, but that everyone's still uncomfortable with it because of this tremendous denial that was taking place. There was even a more powerful denial taking place more recently, and that was associated with a development in the 70s and 80s that was filled with all kinds of attention to space, but ended up in many ways being the most powerful blunting force of any early development of significant spatial explanatory thinking about urban spatiality in an explanatory framework. And that was this sort of double development, first coming from a French sociological tradition and epitomized in the work of Manuel Castells, his early work, particularly the urban question, and the other, the development of a Marxist geography in response to the kind of narrowing that was taking place in the field of Anglophonic geography due to its strong positivist acceptance within the field of geography, that these two areas, a kind of Marxist urban sociology and a kind of Marxist geography in particular, drew upon the works of one of the most important spatial thinkers in the 20th century, Henri Lefebvre, writing heavily on space in the 60s and the 70s, drenched their work in discussions of space, the city, the built environment, the urban condition, but nevertheless began to set a boundary on the possibility of putting cities first, of exploring the explanatory power of urban spatiality. The most powerful here was Manuel Castells' The Urban Question, in which he not only engaged in this very powerful, and obviously he enjoyed it, smashing of the Chicago School as mere ideology, using that biting phrase that some of you in the audience have been forced to write essays on. He used the phrase, "the city takes the place of explanation," as if this was just totally unacceptable. The city is being used to explain social phenomena. This is unacceptable. Fetishism, spatialism, ecologism. And of course, not only was the Chicago School criticized, but his mentor, Henri Lefebvre, who, with Michel Foucault and others, were probably the most important figures trying to create a revolutionary new way of thinking about space in the late 60s and early 70s. What was happening with these new developments was a kind of shunting aside of these new arguments by Lefebvre in particular. Foucault was just totally ignored. Lefebvre was a Marxist, so the Marxists had to contend with a Marxist talking about urban revolution and urban spatial causality. So they couldn't ignore Lefebvre. They ignored Foucault entirely to this point. Today, if you'll hear David Harvey speak, he usually tries to take a special pot shot at Foucault's spatial thinking, if he mentions Foucault at all. But Lefebvre was a much different figure. Both Castells and Harvey brought Lefebvre to a much wider audience. A lot of people began to read Lefebvre because of the writings. But at the same time, Castells directly and Harvey somewhat less directly began to say, he goes too far, however. Read him, he's very interesting, but be cautious when he starts getting excited about the importance of urban space. This is unacceptable. So what happened, as I say, was a kind of blunting of the early origins of what I think 25 years later developed into the spatial turn. Why it took 25 years for this to occur was in part related to this kind of deflection that was taking place by some of the most important spatial thinkers of the 60s and the 70s. Okay. Indicative of the work that began to turn things around, particularly in Lefebvre, was that he did indeed put cities first and began to develop a whole series of arguments, which I'm not going to be able to go over today, but simply summarize with one particularly interesting statement from Lefebvre, and that is, the development of society is conceivable only in urban life, through the realization of urban society. Well, this is written some time ago. And as I said, for 25 years, this was, well, I don't know, I'm not sure what he's saying here. He likes the city and the city is important. But I think it's only now, again, when there is a much larger audience understanding the importance of spatial thinking and spatial forms of explanation, that this notion can be more effectively understood. Well, what I want to do next is put some of this explanatory power to work and give you some examples, and I'll keep you awake at least with some slides. I usually don't have slides, but I do have a few that I would like to show. What I'm going to do is to go back 12,000 years and look at the debates on the origins of cities from this new perspective to see whether we can understand the old debates differently by putting cities first or putting the explanatory power of urban spatiality in a powerful position in making sense of major developments that were taking place 12,000 years ago. And then my second example, I'll fast forward as fast as you can imagine, over those 12,000 years to the present, where I'm arguing in the study of the restructuring processes and globalization processes of the past 30 years, the notions of synecism and the explanatory power of urban spatiality has been resurrected in a significant way, and also illustrates the new insights that can be derived from putting cities first. So let's just take a look first at a wall painting, an 8,500-year-old wall painting found in an archaeological dig at a place called Çatalhöyük in south-central Anatolia. This is a reproduction of this painting, of this wall painting. It's most art history books will recognize it as the first landscape painting. The Guinness Book of Records, in a very strange thing, calls it the first nature painting. But this is not a nature painting. It's just the opposite of a nature painting. It's a painting of a cityscape, of a transformation, a major transformation of nature that was taking place beginning about 12,000 years ago. Çatalhöyük was probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, of a whole series of urban settlements that were developing throughout this period in the highland regions surrounding the alluvial Mesopotamian Tigris-Euphrates basin. These were the centers of what I think needs to be called the first urban revolution. By the way, if you look up Çatalhöyük on the web, you'll find an extraordinary number of web pages. There's a major international dig going on there right now, led by one of the most spatial of all archaeologists, who has been central to the introduction of spatial thinking to archaeology for the last 20 years, and that's Ian Hodder. Again, focusing upon, as Ricky thought I might discuss, this settlement, this first city, among the first cities of the settlement of Çatalhöyük. I started digging into Çatalhöyük after I saw this wonderful urban painting. By the way, there's about 75 of these compound footprints. This is almost a perspectival kind of picture of the city. The figure above is a red volcano, a mountain called Hagandas, which is it's the source of volcanic glass or obsidian. And this obsidian was a vital part of the trading networks within which Çatalhöyük emerged. But what's most important is that it emerged as a hunting and gathering city. That is pre-agricultural. And what is most interesting about this first city is that it appears that agriculture or full-scale agrarian society may have developed out of the city itself. Interestingly enough, digging a little bit into this, one comes across an absolutely remarkable book, like sort of Foucault's earlier work and Lefebvre's earlier work, a book that was forgotten for the most part for about 20 years after it was published, because in many ways nobody could really understand or even conceive that what was being said in this book could possibly be true. And this is a book called The Economy of Cities, written by Jane Jacobs, published in 1969, at a time when she was in very much in kind of competition with Lewis Mumford, the sort of arch anti-urban regionalist, as sort of for the mantle of the leading urbanist in the United States. Mumford had just published The City and History in 1961, and this magnum opus had established him very firmly. The first excavations of Çatalhöyük took place in around mid-1960s under James Millart. And then afterwards, being significantly influenced by James Millart, Jane Jacobs wrote The Economy of Cities, which starts out, which is an example, the primary example going back then, of putting cities first. What she does, starting with what she calls New Obsidian, which was the precursor of Çatalhöyük in her argument, what she says is that this new settlement, the settlement in Anatolia, and the series of other settlements, which, by the way, she predicted would be found, hunting and gathering settlements of substantial size. The only one found but when she was writing this was Çatalhöyük. Subsequently, there are tens of others that have been discovered. They're discovered almost every day. Just the last year, two others have been discovered. Ancient cities that sort of befuddle the architecture, the archaeological canons. But what she then said was that here we had the first urban spatiality, the first socially produced city space, and out of it became unusual innovations. By the way, she poo-pooed even agriculture. But she started to talk about other major innovations. The first known metallurgy and metalworking, the first textiles and weaving, the first primitive ceramics, brilliant artistic works, not only this, but other artistic works, major sculptures, extraordinarily detailed interior decoration of the houses. A number of things were derived from the first cities. And then she began to explore a scenario to suggest how full-scale agriculture came from these first cities. Why don't we just flip through the other slides quickly and come back to them. So the next slide is of the wall painting itself. Found, as I say, in the 1960s. Next. This is just a picture of some of the settlement focus. Patterns and housing patterns in Çatalhöyük. Next.
Sorry, can you focus?
This is a picture of the settlement, or at least part of the settlement of Çatalhöyük. You see, there are no interior roads. It's almost an adobe-like settlement with people accessing houses by ladders from the roof. A very different kind of urban space in which much of the activity was taking place on the roofs themselves and in, of course, the rooms below. Almost every one of these households had shrines within them, indicative of a kind of egalitarian religion that many said was probably matriarchal at the time. And as you can see, there's no walls. The oldest city known, an older city was Jericho, of course, with its famous walls, even at its establishment. But these were not heavy walls here at all, but nevertheless, they were relatively protective in terms of putting a hard face outside. The next slide. This is the site with Häagen-Dazs in the background that was drawn in that wall painting in Çatalhöyük. Can you just let's go back and contemplate the first slide again, and that's it for my slides. What she was doing and how Jane Jacobs explained what was happening, this extraordinary explosion of major developments and innovations in human history coming from the formation of cities, from the initial formation of cities. She explained this as coming from what she described as a self-generating and developmental spark of urban economic life. Something very much like what I've been calling cynicism. She then went into an even bolder argument. And sometimes even I won't accept her exaggerated arguments, but at the core of what she's saying is something very important and powerful. She proceeded to say that every single major innovation in human history, in the development of human societies, every single major development was rooted in this self-generating developmental spark of urban economic life, the stimulus of urban agglomeration. She caps this off in a typical wry way, more recently actually, by making the statement, if we didn't have cities, we'd all be poor. That makes one think about the arguments. It has only been through the kind of generative power of urban agglomeration that we've been able to develop in any significant way over time. Now, that is about as maximal an argument as one can see, but nevertheless, within it is a powerful restatement of the arguments about the power of urban, of the explanatory power of urban spatiality. Well, I did, why don't we sort of put the lights on? I don't think you need to contemplate this entirely in the dark, although there may be some advantages to that. I will try to quickly finish. The industrial capital city, what I do in Post-Metropolis is to talk about this is the first urban revolution, and then quickly there's a second urban revolution, which is what happened in Sumeria, essentially political revolution. And the third urban revolution happens 5,000 years after that, in the development of urban industrial capitalism, with the Industrial Revolution being essentially rooted in cities, despite the fact you historians might call me the first factories were located outside cities. But full-scale industrial society occurs only through the stimulus of urban agglomeration. Once this agglomeration gets formed, we have the formation of a very different kind of city, this third urban revolution city, and that is the industrial capitalist city, with perhaps one of the prime examples happening up north in the city of Manchester. And indeed, we begin to get some of the most interesting forms of urban studies coming from the work of Engels, observing a particular form of cynicism that becomes established in Manchester, and that this extraordinary concentration, centralization of the working class in the city core of Manchester. Although he was far from thinking that space had a major power in explaining social relations, he did grudgingly suggest that maybe this extreme concentration of the working class had the power of stimulating a new kind of consciousness and a new kind of activism and militancy that might change and have a significant effect on the very nature of the urban capitalist city. And he was absolutely right, because in many ways what happened in Manchester and other early industrial, 19th century industrial capitalist cities was a kind of urban crisis, a very powerful urban crisis coming from, if you want to call it this, the cynicism associated with this particular concentration in the central city. And I think it can be argued very broadly, and I don't have time to make this very clear, that ever since the mid-19th century explosions of the working class, and later in the 19th century, explosions of the working class, the industrial capitalist city has been going through many rounds of spatial restructuring, trying to reorganize urban spatiality in ways that both can find new ways of making profits and expanding the economy, but also find ways of preventing this explosion of a concentrated working class coming together in one place and able to expand again. This creates, I think, a series of periods of significant restructuring, each of them generated by forms of urban crisis, the latest one being what started in the 60s, the last urban crisis, bringing me now from Çatalhöyük up to the present. And that is this contemporary period. And to get through this quickly, I'm going to read the rest, my conclusions. Right. First, I want to note that our understanding of these contemporary processes of globalization and economic restructuring has been significantly advanced by a group of scholars, mainly geographers and planners, who have shaped a broad new field that can be described as a critical study of cities and regions. This growing body of theoretical, empirical, and applied research has not only put to the foreground a critical spatial perspective, it has also hinged upon a rethinking of the powerful forces arising from cynicism, the stimulus of urban and regional agglomeration. While not mentioned specifically, something very much like cynicism can be found in such concepts as innovative milieu, regional innovation systems, industrial districts, economic clusters, regional worlds of production, untraded interdependencies, and the local conventions that make development stick and thereby define competitive advantage in the global economy. Through the development of these concepts, once mechanical and severely limited theories of location and locality have been opened up to a much richer social and cultural as well as geopolitical and economic approaches. And it is perhaps no surprise to find that significant inspiration for many of the scholars working in these new agglomeration studies can be traced back to Jane Jacobs' The Economy of Cities and its creative discussion of the self-generating and developmental spark of city economic life. Thanks to the work of such scholars as David Harvey, the very origins of these economic restructuring and globalization processes have been rooted in the spatial specificities of urbanism. It was the social unrest exploding in the major cities in the world in the 1960s that announced the imminent end of the post-war boom in the advanced industrial countries and the initiation of a period of experimental restructuring of national, regional, and urban economies. As Harvey noted, these were at least in part urban spatial crises, and they would engender a search for what he would so insightfully call a specifically spatial fix. The search for a spatial fix reflected a built-in need for capital, especially in times of crisis, to reorganize its specific geography and built environment in an effort to restore rising profits and economic expansion. Whether seen through the concept of a spatial fix or not, the restructuring of mass production, mass consumption, and welfare state-based national capitalisms that led the post-war boom came to be seen as a fundamentally spatial process by this group. And the same was true for the emergence of the present-day new economies, or a flexible specialization in post-Fordism, the expanded globalization of trade, investment, migration, and culture, the rise of information-centered network societies, and the growing power of giant city regions such as London, Tokyo, and New York. In contrast to the main emphases of the growing globalization literature and its close ties to notions of post-industrialism, the new geopolitical economists saw the new economy as still fundamentally industrial. The city and the region continued to be shaped by industrial production, but the nature of the relationship between industrial expansion and the stimulus of urban agglomeration was changing significantly. The first impact of this economic restructuring was the rapid drying up of the old Fordist industrial nodes and regions as innovative milieu, triggering perhaps the most pronounced deindustrialization ever experienced in the advanced industrial countries. It was this decline that made many believe that the rise of post-industrial society, but so much more would follow to indicate otherwise. Deindustrialization came to be coupled with a recuperative reindustrialization of remarkable proportions, much of it concentrated in what were called new industrial spaces, districts, or clusters. These were typically greenfield sites, not industrialized before, and ranged in size from whole countries, the NICs, the newly industrialized countries, to specialized industrial complexes and technopoles like Silicon Valley, typically located in the once suburban rings of major metropolitan regions all over the world. What was happening here was a breakdown in Fordist agglomeration economies and cynicism, and the creation of new and more flexibly specialized and high technology rooted innovative milieu. In some cases, these regenerative and cynicistic clusters were located in revived old city centers, as with the finance and culture industries in London and New York. But most often, they developed as new centers in the urban periphery. In this, they contribute significantly to a dramatic spatial reorganization of the modern metropolis, in part from the urbanization of suburbia and the creation of much more polycentric city regions. Almost there. The new urban form increasingly blurred the simple dualism that dominated the modern metropolis, the separation between a dense, heterogeneous, lively and highly cynicistic central city and a sleepy, homogeneous world of the suburbs. In its place, there has been developing a more polycentric, networked, globalized, and information-based city region or regional city. The most rapidly growing nodes in this new morphology has spawned an explosion of new terms: outer city, edge city, post-suburbia, technoburbs, silicon landscape, technopoles, metroplex, and my invention, exopolis. As the major metropolis has been turning itself inside out in this paradoxical urbanization of suburbia, there has also been, in many cases, a population flow back into the central city, especially through the mass migration of people from what we used to call the third world. This equally paradoxical peripheralization of the core, the city turned outside in, has created the most culturally heterogeneous cities in history and contributed to increasing polarizations of wealth and power and to the corrosion of character and to other phenomena based on class, race, ethnicity, and immigrant status. It has also created unusually volatile urban landscapes, stimulating with what Mike Davis has described as an ecology of fear and its correlate, security-obsessed urbanism. Emerging from these changes has been a radical restructuring of cynicism. The notion that the stimulus of urban agglomeration would intensify simply with the growing size and density of a single giant city reached its limit with Fordism and has become even less tenable with the effects of the information and communication revolution. However, despite the predictions of some that agglomerations would lose their significant efficiencies in the new information era and be added to the dump of other end of phenomena such as the end of geography and the death of distance, the stimulus of urban agglomeration persists, but in a different form, organized as multiple nodes in regional networks. Large city regions containing more than 1 million inhabitants have today become the major driving forces of the global economy and will soon contain the majority of the world's population. They have not only become the centers of innovation for capital, they are also becoming, slowly, synergistic settings for the development of innovative practices for labor, and especially for the massive concentration of what today are called the working poor. But I am beginning to tell a much larger story, one that brings me back to the public lectures I gave last year and the year before on rethinking what happened in Los Angeles after the uprisings of 1992 and the more recent generation of new spatial movements among the working poor, such as the Bus Riders Union. What these recent events illustrate is another effect of the spatial turn, a growing public awareness of how urban spatiality can serve to constrain, oppress, and control our lives, how such fundamentally spatial processes as globalization and economic restructuring can contribute significantly to injustice and inequality, and most important, how struggles to change urban spatiality and achieve specifically spatial justice and regional democracy can serve to build new and more effective political coalitions. But I cannot go any further into this lecture, for I must come to a conclusion to this one. What I have tried to do tonight is to convince those not familiar with the spatial turn of the potential new insights it can generate. At the same time, I have tried to encourage those who believe they are already participating in the new geography to expand the scope of their already fertile geographical imaginations, especially with regard to exploring the explanatory power of urban spatiality and synergism. To reinforce both these objectives, I will end by repeating Henri Lefebvre's timeless, but certainly not spaceless statement: the development of society is conceivable only in urban life, through the realization of urban society. May this inspire the Cities program at LSE and everyone else involved in shaping our urban and regional futures. Thank you.
Roving microphone, so those of you who have a loud voice, shout if repeat or the question if it's not clear. If I could see some hands, some questions, and if you do want to ask some questions from the back, maybe you should come a bit closer. That would be a good thing. I know the question there, lady at the back. Yeah. Question for at the back, just simply summarizing, is asking Ed Soldier to clarify what for him is the major sort of spark which has changed cities or changing cities.
Well, I think the mechanism is, I don't want to escape into the fact that we're still digging into this concept, but I think there's enough to suggest two things. One, that the explanations about the social division of labor and other explanations of urban change that talk about social processes without spatializing that discussion are also filled with major problems. I don't see them as having a very clear mechanism, because one of the interesting observations of Lefebvre is that social relations remain abstract until they are concretized in space. And until I see, well, I do see in some people like Alan Scott, who take the social division of labor and spatialize it in a discussion of the stimulus of urban agglomeration. And the same thing is true with Michael Storper in his work on regional worlds of production. Now, I'm cautious in giving an answer that's exclusively based on an economic or political economic explanation alone. But I think the political economic explanation is very powerful, and that it derives from urbanization economies, And that is these efficiencies and economies are time-saving efficiencies and economies. They are built upon what we always have reference to but never see as a fundamental part of the stimulus of urban agglomeration, and that's face-to-face communications and the necessity of those transactions that are spatial transactions, creating a kind of density of interaction that is both time and labor saving, as well as stimulating to invention and innovation and rethinking. And so the mechanism, I think, is probably clearer for the stimulus of urban agglomeration and its effect on urban change than I think it is for much of the political economy literature and arguments about the social division of labor. Because the social division of labor in cities and its impact on cities only works through the very nature of urbanness, which has to do in large part with the stimulus of urban agglomeration. Now, I agree, the mechanisms with regard to my argument need to be elaborated and made much clearer, and I didn't do that tonight. I'm hoping you and others will be able to actually clarify those mechanisms and put them into something that, by the way, doesn't contest the spatial versus the social, but realizes that these two are intimately forming each other and are equally interactive without one being privileged over the other, an argument that I've been making for 25 years. Again, this offers an easy way out that I'm trying not to take. But what I'm saying is, by the time we get into the 20th century, the entire world is urbanized. There are no autonomous rural societies anywhere. The Cuban Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, were revolutions that emerged from the political, economic, and other conditions in major cities, and how they affected rural populations. Because, as Jane Jacobs argued in 1969, the rural is an invention of the urban. And that the idea of an autonomous peasantry, you know, everyone in peasant studies is absurd. You don't have an autonomous peasantry. You do have a peasantry that occasionally gets organized to struggle against urban control. And indeed, these are places that offered greater potential for struggles against urban control than Havana or Beijing. And so what happened was that the urban forces were mobilized outside, and they appear as rural revolutions. But I think that is only partly correct as a description, that these were also fundamentally emerging from urban-based politics. I only picked on the sociology.
Do you not think that it's quite interesting that the sociology of technology and science and technology studies in the last 20 years quite parallel in its kind of, even the metaphors, I mean, we have
I seem to be getting away with sort of strange excuses, but I think I agree with you entirely. And if you note, I did say mainly American sociology has been blunted from this, and a few corners of British sociology, and I didn't say Australian sociology, among other things. But you know, yes, there are many sociologists, even in the United States, and perhaps particularly with regard to the sociology of technology, that are engaging in this urban turn as well. I just made a poke because the sociology department at UCLA, in part, but also American sociology has retreated much more so from the city and from the urban than British sociology, Australian, or Canadian sociology. So I just did a side poke, but I think sociology elsewhere has been as vital a part of this spatial urban turn as any other social science, certainly. You have to stand up.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about
literature.
Literature within the 19th century, for example, in the area, this area, whether it's Charles Kingsley or Enon Dumas or Charles Dickens, there's a sort of movement, I think, within the literature. And I'm just wondering, in part, to help me understand, because obviously, Angel was talking about the book before.
The quick answer is absolutely yes. I probably should. I'll repeat the question. The question had to do with primarily with 19th century literature and a number of people, including Dickens and others, who were capturing the very essence of urbanness at the time. How does this then fit with my arguments about something happening in the late 19th century that buried our understanding of the urban? And I think the answer is that I should have made clearer that this burial was particular to the development of Western social theory and social science and the development of the major ideas of scientific socialism and Marxism happening in the late 19th century, in literature, in art, in the arts, outside this development, because the city was always, from Çatalhöyük, influential. These were being observed by writers, by poets. I mean, our understanding. Baudelaire. I can talk about 19th century urbanism being understood brilliantly by writers, poets, artists. Impressionism. The whole thing builds out of the city. You know, this was happening at a time when. Which makes this development even more peculiar and more challenging to understand, the major social theorists were somehow rationalizing a logic which made the city dead as just background, incidental background to hot social process. It's in some ways understandable. The actual formation of the social sciences was built against what? It was built against, in part, theories of environmental explanation and determinism. And city space was thrown into an environmental bag. And so when you threw out environmental causality to establish social will, social consciousness, and social causality, you threw out the space. You threw out spatial explanation. But this was happening, as I say, within the particular formation of the social sciences, and as I say, of scientific socialism, of Marxism, of historical materialism, and was not happening in the rest of the humanities, if you want to call them. History, in part, may be followed a little closer, but historians were probably, again, doing much richer urban analyses in the last half of the 19th century. So this was something very peculiar to social and political thought
happening in the 19th century.
There's another question coming up in a moment. I'd use chairman's prerogative and ask you to maybe expand on an issue which, if you consider, as you've rightly said, this moment in time where across the disciplines there is this urban or spatial turn, the one word that seems to cut across this and generates a whole new language, a whole new discourse, a whole new form for architects, and a whole new management policy is sustainability, this loose and terrible and slippery concept. And I was intrigued that in a way you didn't feed that into your discussion on the rediscovery, in a way, of the importance of the city. Now, I ask this in particularly and try to connect it to a very sort of architectural issue, or the one of our environmental determinism. When you sat here the other day while Richard Rogers was speaking, who is the urban turn par excellence when you come to policy at the moment, refocusing the debate in Britain about putting cities first, quite literally. I saw you wince at the liberty with which terms polycentric cities, sustainable communities were used, and I think, having discussed it a bit with you, it was a wince to do with the fact, but surely just playing around with the space ain't going to solve it. And could you talk a bit more about that? Because I think that's an intriguing issue which cuts across many of the disciplines in this room.
Yes, I could talk more about it, but it's another hour and a half. But no, in both those cases, it sounds like two questions, but I think your intent was that there was sort of one question. Both in the debate on sustainability, in almost every corner of that debate, which I do indeed wince at most of the time, and in the language of Richard Rogers, and in the terms used in his attempt to put cities first, but not cities first as an explanatory. He's putting cities first as a kind of personal taste preference. The difference between sustainability and those arguments, and I that's great. I'm really happy that Richard Rogers is the architect for London. It's fantastic to have somebody who really loves it. It's Jane Jacobs versus Lewis Mumford. I would rather have Jane Jacobs be involved in London in many ways than Lewis Mumford, a very cranky man. But the arguments are unrooted in the processes, the mechanisms that we were talking about before, so that when he talks about favoring density and densification, this to me is neither here nor there. Who cares if he favors density? The real question is where to densify and where not to densify. This is an entirely different question. Then he couches the argument, saying with a traditional process of suburbanization. People are leaving cities for the suburbs, and therefore we must revive the cities. But the places he gives that people are going to are becoming cities themselves. He's completely missing this transformation of the modern metropolis. The urbanization of suburbia is invisible to him because he still has an old model of the metropolis, a very simplified model of, as I say, a central city and a surrounding area. I think similar simple models are at the foundation of sustainability. Sustainability, to me, is much worse than the arguments of Richard Rogers, because sustainability comes from all kinds of false premises. It's really focused so much on a isolated notion of the environment as separate from social and political life. And that we can treat the environment on its own terms by doing our planning of cities. The aim is to somehow preserve a notion of something that really doesn't exist, and that is untrammeled, unsocialized nature. I saw sustainability rise. I have an old interest in Africa. I saw sustainability arise in the anti-urban arguments of rural development specialists in Africa,
who is saying we mustn't give any attention to our cities, and we must develop our rural areas because they're not cities, and we don't like cities, and we don't want cities to even grow. We want to develop the rural areas, and this notion of rural and regional development became the place where the concept of sustainability first began to emerge as a kind of popular catchword for World Bank money, which is where the concept of sustainability originated. And it continues to flourish, largely shaped by international organizations giving money, because sustainability has this deceptive, progressive air to it. And so, as I say, there is several hours of lecturing to the question about sustainability, because it really requires, to use a fancy cultural studies term, some deep deconstruction.
We got your message in 5 minutes. I think that's pretty, I think, winding up.
Well, I another difficult question to answer briefly. I've written an entire book exactly on that, attempting to deal exactly with it, called Third Space. And what I'm arguing, what I argue there is for an equality, no a priori privileging of one over the other, so that from the very beginning we are looking at processes, events, in which we are sensitive to the triple dialectic between the social, the spatial, and the historical, always operating with no one privileged a priori. The problem of the past 150 years came with a kind of presumption that the social and then the historical had to be privileged a priori over the spatial. And what I'm arguing against is that that is incorrect. Ontologically and epistemologically, the three have to be started with as equal. Hence, I've been spending my time dealing with the time-space relationship and with what I call the socio-spatial dialectic, arguing that the social and the spatial are in one another and are mutually causative always. Now, what this does not mean is at the end of an analysis of a particular event that the three must be in total equal balance. I'm not making that argument. I'm arguing when we particularize our attempt to understand and explain, we may find one or the other becoming more significant in our interpretation, emphases on one versus the other. But again, what I'm saying is that everything spatial is simultaneously social and historical, everything historical is simultaneously social and spatial, etc., and that we must learn to start with that triple dialectic in our understanding of the world. Again, the end state may land up with one's interpretation emphasizing one over the other. That's fine, as long as you kept the space in there as long as it was necessary. That's the thing that has not been happening. And what I'm saying now is that I think there's a tremendous amount of work to be done in all kinds of taken-for-granted theories and explanations of all kinds of phenomena because of this weakened muscle of the spatial over the past 150 years. All kinds of things. I think, for example, one of the things that's just been a very interesting thing that I've always wanted to work on, the idea of Hegel as an historian and not understanding Hegel as one of the most powerful spatial thinkers of the entire, of history and philosophy.
is a product of the last 150 years, of this 100 years of socialist Doricism. And I think one can do all kinds of new Hegelian scholarship by seeing him as desperately trying to keep the balance. If anything, I think Hegel was a spatialist. He emphasized space too much. I think Marx turned Hegel on his head twice, from idealist to materialist and from spatialist to historicist. But that's another argument. So I think there's lots of potential for this rebalancing. And the idea is to make sure your epistemology and ontology starts with this a priori. At the end of your analysis, you can go anywhere your mind leads you in terms of emphasis.
I think we have time for 2 30-second questions, one over there and one over here. You, yeah. Can we take 2 questions together, then we can... Say that again?
I'll take the second juicy question first. And the answer is the stimulus of urban agglomeration. The creativity that's coming from this first self-conscious city. This is the first painting of a socially produced environment. Everything else was sort of hunters and gatherers and animals and spears and so on, or individual people sculpted. But this was a kind of intentional painting saying, hey, we live in this extraordinarily interactive environment with nature and second nature, produced human life. And the two are intimately interrelated, hence the volcano back there. This was, you know, we're not alone from nature. This first city is an integral product with nature and a transformation of it at the same time. So I think it is a self-consciousness. No coincidence that the first mirror produced by intentional human hands is produced in Çatalhöyük, as far as we know. The first time we can intentionally look at ourselves, reflect, is in Çatalhöyük, at least as far as we know at this time, maybe something else earlier. Now, the question about the built environment, I'm only cautious to make sure that I'm not interpreted as talking only about the built environment. In fact, I tend to maybe give less emphasis to the built environment than normally would be given in an architecture and urban design program. As much of the city's program is, I do see this as urban spatiality, which is what I'm talking about, which does indeed contain the built environment, as well as, I don't know, this invisible non-built environment that's part of the geography of the city, that has to do with distribution patterns and characteristics of different populations in different area people and their movement in the city. That obviously is taking place within a built environment, but in a sense has a kind of, not really separate, but another nature to it, a different nature to it than the built environment per se. And I think this is an interesting area to begin to explore, because I think each of these has somewhat different dynamics. David Harvey's work on the spatial fix was actually specifically focused on the built environment of capital, although the language he eventually expanded into this larger geographical kind of discussion. But I think there are interesting dynamics in the built environment that reflects everything else we're saying. But it takes it out of the normal framework in which the built environment is most often evaluated, and brings it in. It brings, if you want, architecture and building much, much closer to the concept of urbanism, to a richer geographical concept of urbanism, than normally is the case with this small leap into something called urban design.
It's just after 7:30, and I think we've had a wonderful hour and a half of intellectual stimulation from Ed, and you can see how lucky our students are at the City's program to have people like him around. Before I thank Ed with you, I just want to note that in fact we're having a tiny little exhibition, this is a plug for us, of some of the work which has come out of this project over the last year, which is happening, in fact, out of term, but next week to coincide with graduation. So for those of you who are here and are interested, on the 14th and 15th, is that right, Chris, of next week? The 14th and 15th of December next week, the top floor of the St. Philip's building, a very small little red brick building round the corner here, will be adorned with some of the projects that the students have been working on over the last year. So you're very welcome to that. And in many ways, it does connect to the themes that Ed has been talking about. He was very involved in sitting at the drawing boards with some of the students and saying, no, that's not the way to do it. This is the way to do it. But can I thank you, Ed, enormously for your talk? And we look forward to many years of collaboration here. Thank you.